Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love. Hello, everyone. So I am excited to have you back for the second part of my conversation with John Atack. There's always so much to talk about. And so today, we are diving back into our conversation as we continue exploring his latest work, If Scientology Ruled the World, Sex Magic, Nazi Occultism, Space Aliens, and the Second Coming. In our previous episode with John, we began unpacking the intricate web of beliefs that form the foundation of Scientology. And today, we'll go even deeper, examining the historical connections between Scientology and other esoteric movements, from Madame Blavatsky's theosophy to surprising links with occult practices. John brings his unique perspective as both a former high-ranking Scientologist who reached the level of Operating Thetan Section 5. Yeah, that's a real thing. I mean, as I say these words, I realize how they sound, but that's a real level within Scientology. And as the author of the definitive historical account of the organization, his firsthand experience combined with decades of research makes him one of the most knowledgeable voices on the subject, I think, in the world. We'll explore extraordinary claims about aliens and ancient civilizations and bizarre cosmology that form Scientology's secret upper-level teachings. And John will help us understand how these beliefs connect to broader patterns found in destructive authoritarian groups throughout history. Here is John Atack now. I am so happy to be able to continue this wonderful conversation with John Atack. If you haven't heard the first part, please check it out. Also, with the previous times that he's been on the show, every conversation is interesting, engaging, and takes us in different directions, which I love. John's latest book that we're going to be talking about today and continuing our conversation about is If Scientology Ruled the World, Sex Magic, Nazi Occultism, Space Aliens, and the Second Coming. That's it. So what I would love for you to do is take a moment for people who might not know you, although I can't quite imagine if they've been listening to the show, they don't know you, but just in case, to take a few moments to introduce yourself and we'll go from there.
Yes. When I was 19, I got involved in Scientology. I was a customer, a member of the public. I'd never worked for them. So I was one in 1,000 who were not humiliated and abused as a consequence. I did end up broke, which is fairly typical, and I sold a house and the profits went to Scientology. And I achieved the incredible level of operating Thetan Section 5, which is the, I think by the current count, the 25th of the 28 available super levels of Scientology. OT6 was a training for OT7. OT7 was more finding little beings all over yourself like OT5. And it was, in fact, it was OT8 that stimulated this new book, which was not available when I left 40 years ago. I left Scientology. I was at the center of the independent movement a few months after helping start that in the UK. I lost all faith in Ron Hubbard. I became his biographer. My book, Let's Sell These People a Piece of Blue Sky, sadly remains the only comprehensive history of Scientology. One would have hoped there'd be more. There have been people who've added to it, like Tony Ortega and Chris Owen, for example, who've added historical material, Chris Shelton. But it would be nice if somebody gave us a deep dive into the whole subject again. It'd be nice if there was more than one book. But on the other hand, my book being the only one means that if you want to know the history of Scientology, you've got to buy it. So that's good. That was also the basis for a brilliant biography of Hubbard called Barefaced Messiah by the exceptional biographer and journalist Russell Miller. Probably he had my manuscript. I was his only paid researcher. I was his expert witness in court. So I was very tied into his research as well. And that expanded out over the decades into looking at what are the underpinnings of authoritarian groups, the groups we call cults, destructive cults to be proper, because a cult is not necessarily by definition a bad thing. It's a group that is devoted to a leader or a doctrine, and that's close to the Oxford English Dictionary definition. It's taken on this pejorative context, but nonetheless, my study has largely been of destructive, dangerous cults, hundreds of them over the millennia. Gangs, practices such as hazing in US universities, methods that are used to create conformity and submission. I wrote about that in a book called Opening Our Minds, and that was interesting. Michael Langoni, who was the president of the International Cultic Studies Association when he read it, said it was the first time that anybody had shown that these dynamics figure throughout society. So I wrote about advertising and selling, and there's the same, the groups seem so different, but what they do is fundamentally the same. As Robert J. Lifton, the late, incredible Robert J. Lifton, pointed out in the 8 Deadly Sins of Thought Reform, as you mentioned Bob Cialdini in our last conversation, as he pointed out in his 7 points of influence, there are certain ways of doing this. I had 17 years where I didn't comment at all on Scientology because I was steamrolled by them. The late Arnie Lerma, who put together a remarkable website called lerma.net, that's L-E-R-M-A. He said of me, before the internet and safety in numbers, there was John Atack. There were a few others, but there weren't many of us. And then the internet and alt-religion Scientology, the ARS message board, bang, there were thousands of people who, because they could cloak themselves in anonymity and therefore hopefully not suffer the daily harassment that I suffered, you know, everything started to go against Scientology finally. And I, by then, had thousands of pages of material, including their 800-page intelligence training pack. I made those things available, and that sort of carried on without me. And then in 2012, I came back. Came back because I did a BBC show called Big Questions, and Scientology didn't, I didn't even get a lawyer's letter. It was like, what's happened to them? They'd have been marching up and down the street with placards 17 years ago when I was last doing this. And I realized they were so overwhelmed by criticism now I was told I turned their intelligence, their UK intelligence chief in 1993. She came out, and after a 3-hour conversation, she decided she didn't want to be involved with that anymore. This is the person who'd been running the harassment on me for 18 months. That was quite something. But to see how deeply involved people are, and I did a lot of work. I've worked with about 600 people in their recovery from Scientology. It's not something I tend to do anymore. You know what it's like. You get very involved with these things and with these people. It's deeply affecting. I'm interested in the mechanics of this. How does this work? I put forward ideas about human predators, and which are gaining a little bit of traction. A guy came to me the other week saying he's going to do a doctoral thesis based upon this, which is wonderful. Dustin Rosario Steinhagen. I was on a PhD committee, to my own amazement, as I have no academic qualifications whatsoever. Dropped out of school at 17. A couple of years in art college later on, but you can't really call that an education, can you? But he was, in fact, completed a PhD in cybersecurity. And I'm kind of, why do you want me? And he said, because there are more references to your book, Opening Our Minds, than any other text. This is something that people in cybersecurity are just not thinking about. So interesting spin-offs. With this book, it started with, there was this mysterious bulletin called Student Briefing for Operating Thetan Section 8, dated the 5th of May, 1980. This is the highest level of Scientology. This is where you are meant to learn to be at cause, not just mentally, but also physically, over matter, energy, space, and time. So you can actually make things appear and disappear. You've become a magician. You've entered the world of Fantasia with Walt Disney, probably. And this is a promise that Hubbard had made throughout Scientology, right from the beginnings of the subject in February 1952. He's saying, you'll have superpowers. Nobody got any superpowers, not yet. We can be pretty sure that I wouldn't be talking now if any of them did have, but sadly they don't. So here it was, finally, Hubbard very sensibly died before releasing this.
Very sensibly.
And 2 years later, 1988, it was released. This bulletin begins the OT8 course, and it's jaw-dropping. Now, I'd already seen it. It had already leaked, despite their incredible security, and I'd seen it and gone, yes, whoever wrote this knows what Hubbard thinks, but there's no way he'd be stupid enough to tell people that he's with the Antichrist and Lucifer, and that the whole intention of Scientology is to stop the second coming of Christ, which will be a Markabian invasion. It was on the course for a week. Two people who did it left and made it public, even though the security meant they couldn't copy it. I've since talked directly with one of the people who was there when this bulletin was issued. There is no doubt it's authentic, but it's been withdrawn now. So here he is. The purpose of Scientology is to stop the second coming of Jesus Christ, which is an invasion of Markabians. And I went, well, let's take this apart, because if this is the central purpose of Scientology, what would happen if Scientology took the world over?
Yes. I mean, when you start learning about all of this, and with Scientology, you learn about the Markabians, you learn about implant stations, invader forces on Mars, BTs and clusters, and Venus.
Where the temperature is, the median temperature is plus 400 degrees centigrade. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's a little bit too hot.
Yeah, slightly.
Mars is minus 40. Let's send Elon Musk there right away. And these invader forces decided they'd live on a really cold planet and a boiling planet, and the prison planet would be here. I mean, according to Hubbard, there are train lines on Venus where the bacteria, the only things that can live at that temperature, are going about their work.
When you hear this terminology, I think about, I wrote this down when reading your book that I couldn't put down. Sector Commander, Sector 9, Galactic Patrol. Okay, so when I hear that, what I picture is kids with walkie-talkies. Sector 9, like it feels very immature.
9-year-olds.
Right. Very childlike, warlike, with the little army men, little green army men, laying on your stomach, on your elbows, doing pew, pew. Unfortunately, though, it's made into a whole big thing. I do want to say that most people heard about Scientology through Dianetics, and in your book, you have this really delicious review of Dianetics by Isidore Isaac Rabie. I have it in front of me here because I didn't want to get it wrong. He had won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1944, so he knew a couple things. And he read Dianetics, and in the January 1951 issue of Scientific American, he wrote, "This volume probably contains more promises and less evidence per page than has any publication since the invention of printing." So let's go from there, where it's based on what feels like nothing. It's like smoke and mirrors based on this review. And let's go back in time to where this started, potentially unwittingly, and what it's connected to and the progression, because that's always fascinating to me. And I like that you are someone who can get into the details, but also you're a systems thinker, which I could tell because you zoom out and you see how things are connected, which I really value. So having both of those lenses, the zooming in and zooming out, is really important here. So let's go back to Madame Blavatsky, if you don't mind.
Well, let's go back before Madame Blavatsky.
Let's go to
1882. The year is 1882. I remember it well. And there's a man called Ignatius Loyola Donnelly, who will four times sit in the US Congress, or four terms. He was the author of three books. One of them was one of the early books proposing that Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare, which is a very popular idea and still is. We won't get into that. We talk about that for hours. I'm fascinated by that too. But he was one of the people putting forth the idea that somebody else had written this. I only care that somebody did write it personally. That's the important thing. But he also wrote a book saying that the Viking gods were real. And in 1882, he published a book, which I think is called Atlantis, the Lost Continent. This is an amazing idea that he's got hold of. There are only, historically, the only people who've ever mentioned Atlantis before this, I believe, were Plato, the philosopher, and Herodotus, the historian. Plato twice, in two different essays, mentions Atlantis. And the story is, I think 9,000 years before, according to an Egyptian priest who's talking to Plato, the Athenians, who of course at that time didn't exist, had fought a war with the people of Atlantis. This is where Atlantis comes into history. Or not really history, is it? 9,000 years ago, Rachel, your ancestors fought a war with the Muppets. No, it's all true. So this guy floats this idea, and the people who live in Atlantis are called the Aryans. I do get into where that word comes from, and that's quite fascinating in and of itself, because it's one of those grabs where pseudoscience grabs a term. Like if you talk to people in the New Age about quantum entanglement, for example, and you understand that they haven't got a clue what it means. Nonetheless, it sounds sciencey, and that's a really big thing. So Madame Blavatsky is already relatively well known and has this incredible past. One of her biographers said she was the most learned, if not the wisest, woman of the 19th century. And I think that's a good summary. She was an amazing intellect, not like Ron Hubbard. She really had read a huge amount of material. She spoke, by my count, nine languages. And she had studied with secret teachers among the Sufis, the Freemasons, the Rosicrucians, Indian teachers. There are Mahayana Buddhists who say that her grasp of Mahayana is excellent. And she poured all of this stuff together and smoked a huge amount of cannabis and therefore rambled. And there's this 1,500-page book in 1888 called The Secret Doctrine. And I had terrible trouble with this. I spent about 4 months. I was trying to understand this as I was writing the book. And then one day the penny dropped. And I realized that the ideas are actually really simple. But if you smoke a lot of dope and then say it, her idea is that it's anti-Darwin. Darwin is, and before him, Charles Lyell, have really upset people by saying, oh, Bishop Usher, when he said counted up the dates in the Bible and worked it out, and God created the earth in 4004 BC. And Lyell had come along and said, I think it was more like 100 million years ago, looking at the striations of rock. And then Darwin comes along and says, and we evolved along with Alfred Wallace. We shouldn't ever forget Alfred Wallace, who independently, and who was a spiritualist, by the way, which I don't really get into in the book. There you go. So the whole establishment is having a problem with this. Oxford and Cambridge universities, their dons are not allowed to teach Darwin. So then there are all sorts of, Norman Cohn wrote a brilliant book called Noah's Flood, I think. He shows you this turmoil that's happening in the academic world, where everything they teach to be a don, a professor at Oxford or Cambridge, you have to be a cleric. You have to be a member of the Church of England. And now all of this is being questioned. And Blavatsky is part of the movement among, let's call them mystics, I'm not really sure it's the right word, to say, no, this isn't so. She therefore puts forward her idea, which is that somewhere between 200 and 300 million years ago, intelligent life began on Earth. The latest estimates for Homo erectus is 2 million. For Homo sapiens, when I was a kid, we were 40,000 years old. We might now be between 300 and 400,000 years old. And we've got a bit of Denisovan and a bit of Neanderthal in us. And this is all scientifically verifiable now. You can add everything together with carbon dating, with DNA, and you can find out from the mitochondrial decay, if you want to get into that with DNA, when these things happen. But she says, no, it wasn't 300,000 years ago. It was 300 million years ago. And the first beings were incorporeal. They didn't have any physical form. And because they were sinful, gradually beings became more solid, an idea which Hubbard will reflect on in his own way. And you then get a series of races. She calls them root races. The word root is not really particularly necessary. And the next lot actually reproduce by dividing. So they're kind of spiritual beings with some tangible form now because they can divide, and they're kind of like amoeba. You know, they divide to multiply. You then go through a series of these races until you get to the fifth root race. This is the Atlanteans. And she picks up this myth of Atlantis, which has no basis in history, no basis in archaeology whatsoever. It's just the rambling of a guy who's in the US Senate, fundamentally. And with the name Ignatius Loyola, is presumably a Catholic, unless his parents are feeling mean, I don't know. So we have this random idea. She then has, however many million years ago, and there is a little chart in the book for anybody who wants to see, a couple of million years ago, there were these super beings, the Aryans, who had electron powers. The word electron has just come into the language in 1888. Max Planck and his friends are going to be playing with it. And they are a race apart, and gradually stories start to develop around them. From Blavatsky, and she talks, for example, about, if we're going to check facts, she predicts things for the future that haven't happened, and she explains the past in ways that are not substantiated. So, for example, for a million years, a war was fought in the air, a terrible war. And I kind of look at that and I go, well, look, if you walk over any of the battlefields, the Civil War in the US or the Civil War in the 17th century here in England, you will find them littered with lead, with shot. How were they able to have a million years of war? These wars each lasted 4 years. How were they able to have a million years of war and not leave any trace? Of course, they didn't have aeroplanes because in Blavatsky's time, they didn't have aeroplanes. So these were all dirigibles. They're all balloons, which for a million years were fighting each other. It's like, oh no. So she develops these ideas. And there's a man called Dr. Franz Hartmann, who's a fascinating character. I tried to get in touch with the newly formed Hartmann Society, who are now promoting his works. I received responses from their email address telling me that the people I'd written to were nothing to do with it, which was kind of weird that the email address for the society was referring it off. I've gone through four of his books to try and understand this, and it seems to me he was very intelligent, quite decent, and from my perspective, misguided in his thinking, but he seemed like a decent person. How come this man, who was one of Madame Blavatsky's closest friends, was the head of one of the two German Theosophical societies, how come he was a founder of the Ordo Templi Orientis, the sex magic society? How does that fit together? They didn't answer, so I'm afraid I'm stuck with that. This guy, Dr. Franz Hartmann, fascinating character. He's a Bavarian doctor. There is some question as to whether he ever qualified as a doctor, but he worked as an eye surgeon in Colorado for 12 years. Got involved with spiritualism, went, but they're all fakes. I can see what they're doing. Then read Blavatsky and went, this is what I want. And I think that would have been Isis Unveiled, her first major book. He went to India to meet her. That's how serious he was. And this isn't like you grab a plane and hop over there. This is weeks of travel to get there. They became great friends. Then the beginning of the 20th century, he's one of the three founders of the Ordo Templi Orientis, which will be taken over by Aleister Crowley, which is a society practicing ritual sex magic, trying to achieve superpowers, electron powers, by the practice of magic, by enslaving elemental beings, or body thetans, as Hubbard would later call them, and by taking the power of deities and using it. So there he is there, but not only is he the head of the Theosophical Society, or a Theosophical Society, a founder of the OTO, the Order of the Eastern Templars, he's also a member of the Guido von Liszt Society. And as far as I know, nobody's pointed this out before. Guido von Liszt is the fount of the Aryan race fantasy. He, as a teenager, lives in Vienna, and his dad takes a party of people into the catacombs at St. Stephen's Cathedral one night, and he gets separated from the party and falls to his knees, age 13 or something, and starts praying to Wotan or Odin or the head of the Norse gods, a figure about whom we know almost nothing because there is nothing written from that period. So most of the stories we have been made up in the last couple of centuries. And he vows that he will build a shrine to Wotan. He then creates this idea, which Blavatsky most certainly hasn't, though she is racist in her attitudes. She is anti-Semitic, but mildly compared to what was going to happen. She believes, that, as Carl Gustav Jung did, that the Jewish consciousness is separate from the Christian consciousness in some alarming and strange way. Don't know what happens if you're a convert, you know, either way, whether you get into the other consciousness or not. Not really a believer in the collective conscious, unconscious, or conscious, or any of it. These ideas, he then has a pupil, the Liszt Society is formed, and these are people who are fundamentally anti-Semitic. They believe themselves, they're part of a movement called the Pan-German Movement, because with the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, begun by the Prussians' attack on them in the 1860s, the various parts of the empire and the language groups are coming apart. There are Czechs, there are Romanians, there are Bulgarians, various Slavic peoples. Magyars, the Hungarians, are quite separate linguistic culture, and there are Germans, and the Germans are dominant, and they want to maintain that dominance in this empire that's in collapse anyway. And they create pan-German societies. Alongside that, you have pan-Slavic societies, and what's happening in Russia and Ukraine is pan-Slavism, with Russia saying, we own all of the Slavic countries, they're part of our empire, because when Ivan the Awesome was Tsar, he ruled all of these things, so therefore they belong to us. I'd like to point out that Ukraine actually founded the empire, if we're going to get really serious about this, but let's not go there. This set of ideas become rigidified into a code which says that there are these separate people, the Aryans, who descend from the heavens. They came down in ice. Hubbard will refer to this as the ice cubes, and I'm grateful to Chris Shelton for reminding me of that. But they are the offspring of the gods. And Blavatsky has said that the Aryans miscegenated. They bred with lesser creatures. And she's got this lovely passage about these dumb animals that were made that were covered in orange fur. It's like, okay. And they lost their electron powers. We then go through this line and we get to the amazing reality that the Thule Gesellschaft, Thule Society, where the Nazi Party is actually founded. The NSDAP is founded by members of or fellow travelers of this group, including Rudolf Hess, Hans Frank, Dieter Eckhart, who will recruit Hitler. They create the political party within a society that is an offshoot of the Germanenorden, which is a ritual magic society. And so we have the origins of Nazism among this group of people. They will later be joined by Heinrich Himmler and by Heydrich, who are absolute believers in all sorts of occult nonsense. At Wevelsberg Schloss, his castle, where he gave SS officers lessons in meditation and yoga, Heinrich Himmler had a round table where, when the Knights of the Round Table reincarnated, they would be able to go there and hang out. So, you know, King Arthur and all of his mates, who are all inventions of literature, by the way. This is another place that I've studied in great depth. I read all of Chrétien de Troyes, The Parsifal by Wolfram. What an incredible book. But you can see the story getting better and better in every telling until you get to Tennyson at the end of the 19th century. So things like Lancelot's not in the original. In fact, nobody's in the original story. There's only Arthur in the original story. And it's written 300 years after it happens. The Holy Grail transforms from being a fish dish with a light on it to being the cup that Jesus' blood got into. That's during the 14th century that that happens. So you can see these ideas progressing when you bother to look. Aryan race fantasy is exactly the same. But when you pin down the development of the ideas, they are completely fanciful. There is no basis in reality needed. Himmler and his group will then try and infect the Nazi party with these beliefs. A couple of people have written very good books about this. What was surprising to me, and is contentious, was to find that, yes, there were occultists there. Hitler was never one of them. There have been all sorts of attempts to connect him. And finally, there's one book, which I do bring up, Ernst Schertl, about magic, which is an extremely interesting book, which was found in Hitler's library. But it was given to him after he became chancellor. So it's not what inspired him to do what he did. It's a guy called Liebenfels who followed Liszt as the head of the Aryan race society nonsense, who would later claim that Hitler had begged occult magazines from him in Vienna. There's nothing to support this idea. Then Hitler, in fact, seems to have been a-religious. He, in fact, there's a statement that I found where he says he's glad that he's got over religion. He's been able to leave it. This is before the Second War. But on the other side of him, you've got the Protestant churches. And this is a point that has to be made. There's a great book by a guy called Richard Seligman Gall called Holy Reich. He's a historian. He's absolutely determined to put over this view, which has not really been said. Eugenics, which is one of the other threads of the book, actually is being practiced in Germany 12 years before Hitler comes to power. It's approved of by Christian churches. It's approved of in the US, where the biggest eugenics program has happened. In the UK, where the word eugenics comes from, the parliament would never allow sterilization of those considered unfit, life unworthy of life, as the Nazis would call it. So you've got these threads of belief that tangle and become Nazism. But it's worth bearing in mind that the 28 Protestant churches, only one of which, the Confessing Church, was actually Nazi in its origins, are all supported by the Nazi regime and are all willing to believe that Jesus was a Gentile and that his mission was the destruction of the Jews. This is taught throughout Germany, through the universities and schools from 1933 to 1945. And within the Christian church. So I was surprised. I had no idea of this in all the history I've read, that there was this other strand. You've then got the pseudoscience of eugenics. Richard Dawkins, who's not one of my favorite people, I hate to admit it. I'm an agnostic, so I'm not bothered by his atheism in the least. I'm bothered by the simplistic arguments he puts forward for it. I also do not believe in selfish genes. I think that's a ludicrous idea. We are not just a set of replicating genes. We have epigenetic change. We have change, cultural transmission. We can learn things. We don't have to behave as our ancestors did. We don't have to behave as our fellow chimpanzees behave because we can change our minds. Dawkins, a couple of years ago on Twitter, and he's a professor of scientific education and a biologist at Cambridge, I think. He put out a tweet saying, well, if you can do it to dogs and horses and pigeons, then why can't you do it to people? And the answer is very simple. If you're breeding horses to race, if you're breeding dogs to have pushed in faces, they're single trait things. The complexity of a human being is such that he should know this. He really should know this. I actually get into how many genes are related to, sorry, it's not an elaborate thing, but how many genes there are that are related to intelligence, for example. And you can't breed this. The guy who invented the word, Galton, who invented the word eugenics, meaning good birth, his idea was that pretty women should marry smart men. And it's like, so nothing's changed. This is what the aristocracy have been doing for years. Actually, some pretty stupid men were marrying some quite intelligent women along the way as well, thankfully. But this idea of selective breeding, which keeps coming back, and is genetically impossible. One of many things that was fascinating to me, I found out so much researching this book and was able to synthesize and bring together these ideas, And it fascinated me that this eugenic idea that has been so pulled apart was actually first disproved by the Nazis. And this is something I've not read anywhere. But when you see just how much work they did to prove this idea that the Teutons were different from the Mediterraneanoids and were different from the Semites and this, that, and the other, they absolutely proved that you can't tell. There is no marker. They did fingerprints, ears, skull sizes, blood types, calf muscles, measures that ran into the hundreds of thousands of people, and they were never able to accurately type any of their forms, including the Aryans. But alongside this, of course, Himmler developed the Lebensborn program, where blonde, blue-eyed women, that was the basic qualification for being Aryan, would have sex with SS officers and give birth to children. We don't know how many children, at least 8,000. The most famous of them is Frieda with ABBA, the band ABBA. She was a Lebensborn child with an SS officer as her father. And at least 8,000, perhaps 20,000 children were born. What Himmler believed was that through this selective breeding, the single trait he was looking for was electron powers. That brings us all the way back to Scientology. The purpose of Scientology is to superpowers, electron powers. So you have these things running along. And then the final and most chilling thing, which is that if Scientology did rule the world, then that bulletin, which has been taken off the highest level course, David Miscavige, or whoever is in charge of Scientology by this time, will believe that anybody who objects to Scientology or Hubbard is a Markabian. All you need to do is check them on an e-meter, and then you can exterminate them because they're not human. And I had never thought that through in all of these years. They don't have power. If the Nazis had not got power, there wouldn't have been any concentration camps. And so a movement that is fundamentally hateful towards anybody that criticizes it, as we well know, will silence any opposition to its ideas. Now, in case anybody's sweating by this point, I don't think Scientology will take the world over because they are utterly incompetent. But nonetheless, there are now, I mean, 1993, a friend and I sat down and we listed 200 splinter groups from Scientology, including the big ones like EST, people like Darfrey John, Eckencar with Paul Twitchell, Abilitism, Silver Mind Control. In fact, most of the origins of EST are other Scientology offshoots. And it could be, and my concern, I've never thought Scientology would take the world over, but my concern is that a group that's influenced by them could, just as Steiner's Anthroposophy is now infiltrated not only Silicon Valley, it's also involved in the Dutch government. And these are silly 19th century fabulisms. These are not sensible ideas. This isn't science. And they teach pseudoscientific notions. And in my experience of, I've known four people whose childhood was in a Waldorf school, and they all came away dyslexic. They all came away not wanting to read anything and feeling that the experience had been bad for them. But it shows that a group that cannot demonstrate the efficacy of its methods can rise to tremendous power, just as the Nazis did.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Don't need to read the book now.
Right. Just a small point when you're talking about Steiner and Waldorf. As I've worked with a number of people who were teachers in Waldorf schools, who were students in Waldorf schools, some of the things that they told me, while they felt that the environments were lovely and you spoke in kind of a whispery tone and you were supposed to be connected to nature and fairies and sprites and things that live in the trees, okay, but also that you weren't supposed to ask questions. If you ask a question, then oftentimes what these people who were teachers there and students would say is that they were taught that when a child is ready for that information, it will somehow come to them. Now, this might be different in different Waldorf schools. Quoting it for the people I've heard from who were in different places, some in Los Angeles, some in New York. And so the unquestioning devotion, the don't question what we're doing, with other ideas given for why that's important, that you're going to overwhelm someone's mind if you give them information before they're ready to take it in.
Overwhelm my mind. Please overwhelm my mind. I love it.
Right? Yeah. One parent was telling me that she saw her child who had ADHD, that they were measuring his brain. She didn't know that's what was happening until they had sort of a secretive way of doing it where they were trying on different hats for different things, literally trying on different hats. And then she saw the hat being brought into the principal's office. And so the measurement could be made about the size of his brain, which was, I mean, it just takes us right back to what you're talking about. And I think people there don't know that there are all these connections and that they are, once again, unwittingly involved in moving something forward into people's lives that has very questionable beginnings and is also setting a precedent and setting up ideas for us versus them. It is quite problematic, but also the unquestioning part, I was found chilling that to have unquestioning be a principal within a school system. And again, I don't want to hear from people who are in Waldorf schools where they can't ask questions. That can happen too. But there are a lot of Steiner ideas that are used, I think, with more orthodoxy in certain Waldorf schools than others, but they are there. And it's important to know them. And it's important to know where all this comes from. The idea of there being this need for purity, I really wonder about that because there have been so much science to show that when people from different cultures, different ethnic groups join together, that it actually builds a certain amount of strength. And that, I mean, from having raised children, but also always having dogs, the dogs I had who were purebreds often had more issues than the ones who were considered mutts, which I always found very interesting. But the ones who are purebreds, I mean, those are the ones that I'm sure, I mean, I got them at different shelters, but I'm sure if I needed to purchase them, they'd be very expensive. But they had so many issues because of being purebred. And so it goes against science, I mean, if we're really looking at it, but it still holds true for so many people and drives them to do atrocious things. I really wonder about why it has such sticking power.
It seems on the face of it that you're breeding towards something exceptional, and surely that's great. But as you say, racehorses have problems that farm horses don't have. Greyhounds most certainly have problems that other dogs don't have. Pugs and bulldogs, of course, will tend to be asthmatic. The King Charles Spaniel, often the brain is too big for the brain case. And they're very pretty dogs, but can suffer terrible psychiatric problems. Some decades ago, the BBC stopped broadcasting the Crufts dog show on the grounds that these breeds were possibly, it was inhumane to be maintaining these breeds. You then, in biology, you come across the idea of hybrid vigor and something which any gardener will be used to. You have what are called F1 seeds, which maintain their power by being rebred from the same two parents in every generation. So the sun gold tomato, for example, you have to breed two other varieties to get the seed, and that will give you the sun gold. And the sun gold's fantastic tomato. What can I say? I grow them myself. In fact, I ate one today. What can I say? And it was delicious. It was really delicious. But what you also know is if you pick an apple and you take the seed from that apple, you won't get the variety that you picked. The apple, in fact, does fall far from the tree because it is the male parent that determines, rather than the female, what you'll get. So there you go. There's a cliche gone. But in looking, I read three books about eugenics, which was absolutely fascinating, the stupid things that people have believed. And the reality is Adam Rutherford, who is a geneticist, that's what he does. And he's saying, we've all got Aborigine genes, everybody. We've got Denisovan genes, we've got Neanderthal genes. This demand for purity, as you say, if you got to it, there's only one species I can think of that is unique, and that's the banana. They may be red and they may be yellow, and they may be small and they may be large, but they're all part of one species, the Cavendish. And the day will come when a disease hits the Cavendish banana and it is wiped out completely. Because one of the terrible things, you know, Pol Pot did, was to destroy the seed banks in Cambodia. And those seed banks held almost 2,000 different varieties of rice, most of which are now lost to the world. If a disease hits our rice, then the more varieties we have, the better. So with grapes in the 19th century, when all the vineyards in Europe were wiped out by phylloxera, I mean, everything went. They found that if you took the few remaining samples of vines they had and transplanted them onto the Zinfandel, the American Zinfandel rootstock, they survived. The phylloxera couldn't get to them. So, and nobody would have thought of it. It makes a reasonable wine. It's called a Primitivo in Italy. But having that scruffy Zinfandel saved all of the Merlots and the Cabernet Sauvignons and Chardonnays and all of that. And the same thing with human beings. If you breed towards a pure type, you will end up, well, with Habsburgs. Aren't they an excellent example of it with their huge chins, the Bourbon chin? You look at paintings of the Spanish monarchs, and this chin just gets bigger and bigger until they got to the point where they couldn't eat. That's how bad it was. That's what happened. Or the Egyptian pharaohs marrying their sisters. It's not a good idea. It's not a good idea. It's also worth saying about the anthroposophists that while Hitler banned anthroposophy along with everything else in 1935, there were anthroposophists working in the concentration camps because there were two camps that actually had biodynamic farms. And Himmler planned, he gave orders to the SS, and he had 1.25 million troops in the SS. He was their supreme commander. And he gave them orders to kill 30 million Slavs as they went through Eastern Europe. And this is a part of the war that's forgotten, the other Holocaust, which we should be talking about. And they killed at least 20 million, maybe 27 million, the numbers somewhere between there. And the idea was this was the fundamental policy of the Germans, Lebensraum, living space. And they had named the colonies and they'd started populating their colonies. And they were all going to have biodynamic farming. They were all going to have, you plant your seed at the right time of the lunar cycle, which advice is actually passed on by the Royal Horticultural Society in this country. And you're going, where is the science behind this? My mum did it and it seemed to work. It's not scientific. And their whole thing about, you know, putting water through a figure eight and not having any straight lines in your house, so they all look like hobbit houses. Very nice. Burying sheep skulls to make sure that things are fertile. It's a form of modern witchcraft, as of course is witchcraft. Courtesy of Gardner in the 1940s, most of what is considered to be neo-pagan or witchcraft, their inventions, very much like Atlantis and the Aryan race theory, that then claim, as the Freemasons and the Rosicrucians do, to date back to Egypt. Well, if the Egyptians were so smart, if they had the Emerald Tablet and the Book of Thoth, these two magical things that Crowley and so many others talk about, if they had these things, why is it that when they were sending their pharaoh to the other world, that the first thing they did to the corpse was pull the brain out through the nose? Because the brain's a waste of time and it would be thrown away. This is how worldly wise the Egyptians were. And their society made no progress in 1500 years or so. You look at the art, it's just the same, except for when Akhenaten is pharaoh and you get this brief moment of change. So it's a static slave society that these people with their magic would like to return us to or something. It's silly. It's tunnel vision, a failure to look at all of the information and a failure to look at, for me, it's the etiology of things, the way they develop. If you're going to conquer a disease, you need to know its etiology. What are the stages of its development and where can you interfere with that development? I am very much against the current idea, and the most recent iteration is Elon Musk. He's talking about the woke mind virus. I've also heard about the virus of religion. I've also heard about information disease, as Conway and Siegelman in their very interesting paper had it. The virus of atheism I've heard about now. Even professors are using this comparison. You're saying, going, thought is not a virus. A virus is an inanimate thing which latches onto your DNA and replicates itself and becomes alive. That's not what's happening with ideas. We don't think biologically. We are capable of thinking rationally. It's not that you caught the woke virus. And Hitler, of course, pointed out that Judaism was a bacterium. So if we want to go with this anti-scientific silliness, then we can. But it's best not to, because it will lead to tears. There's no doubt about that.
Really, it's best not to. There is also this idea that there is this virus that you have if you're against Trump. This is not a political statement. This is just using this notion that there must be something wrong with you if you think this way.
You're a Malkavian.
You're Markabian, right.
You've got the Markabian virus.
Right. You have a reactive mind that you, whatever it is, just like L. Ron Hubbard talking about people with psychiatric disorders or disabilities, that you have something inherently wrong with you. There are so many people I know I've worked with who didn't have issues before they got involved in Scientology, then did. Then they were diagnosed with a variety of things if they were kind of lucky enough to get treatment. But so often, it wasn't an inherent diagnosis that was part of their wiring. It was situational depression, situational anxiety, situational psychosis brought on by their experiences there. But then we had this idea that you need to ostracize people, as you write about too, who are having psychiatric issues, which is the worst thing to do. Because then people feel isolated, and then people also become more suicidal because they feel very much alone. I mean, he just didn't know at all how to look at these things, how to look at human beings, how to envelop what was true about them and be compassionate, because it just wasn't his wiring. But also, he didn't understand causal relationships, nor did he care. I think when you see the world as the enemy or friend or foe or people that you need to, well, in this very black and white way, look at, you're not operating in the gray at all. And in the gray, I think, is where there is the sophistication, where there is the compassion, where there is the noticing what is true about people when you don't just see them as a friend or foe, but that things are more complicated than that. I don't think that he or a lot of people or the Nazis had any interest in really sitting down and having a conversation where it could be both and. It was always either or. And I feel like that is so simplistic and militaristic.
Absolutely. And I mean, Hubbard was a predator from the beginning. There's a letter written from Savannah, Georgia, second mention of Savannah between us today, in January 1949, which is Hubbard writing to his agent, Forry Ackerman, who he calls 4E. Ackerman shared the correspondence with me. Remarkable character in his own right, Forry Ackerman, incredible man. But he was Hubbard's literary agent from the 1930s onward. And so the bottom of the letter, it says, this is a letter that's not to be shared with anyone. And in the body of the letter, he says, I've just come across this fantastic idea that they'll make so much money. I might take the Catholic Church over, but you can rape women and they'll have no memory of it. There's no mention of it benefiting anybody in any way. And this is the first announcement of what will become Dianetics. You can rape women and they'll have no memory of it. So his son, L. Ron Hubbard Jr., said, Scientology works not as L. Ron Hubbard says it works, but as L. Ron Hubbard intends it to work. And that intention, right from the beginning, I wrote a paper called Never Believe a Hypnotist. It's on my websites in various places. I think there's even a version of me reading it out on my YouTube channel. I don't know why people are interested in that, but never mind. And I just looked at the statements he made in the first couple of years, 50 to 53, about hypnotism. And it was one of those moments in life for me. I'd been writing about Hubbard. I'd already written, Let's Sell These People a Piece of Blue Sky. And I went, well, let's look at what he said about hypnotism. And I was completely floored to find out that he knew exactly what he was doing. He described exactly how it's done. And then did it. And that creating psychological enslavement and then progressing that with his C organization to physical enslavement, where you've got people who are not allowed to have children, who work a 90-hour week, are paid a pittance, who eat rice and beans diets, who I interviewed one woman who'd worked with David Miscavige, and she said she normally got 2 hours sleep a night. That will destroy you physically. That is slavery. And the idea that in Western society, there are these slave camps, and Scientology is not the only group that has them. And because of our protections of religion and the idea of monastic communities, which are largely, from limited experience I have of monastic communities, they do care about the people who are involved there. They don't abuse them. They do pay their national insurance so they can have a pension. Whereas in Scientology, of course, you'd just be thrown out on the street when you're in your 70s. With no support whatsoever. These groups are being allowed to abuse people because legal protection is not offered because of this sort that ascetic religious practice or something's absolutely beyond me, the protection of abuse that the Rehabilitation Project Force in Scientology existed all around the world, in Australia, in Denmark, here in England, in America, and nobody ever went in and said, this is human trafficking. You've got people from all over the world and you've enslaved them. When Mark and Claire Headley tried to do something about that, they were stopped in their tracks.
That's horrible. I mean, also the people who are embroiled in needing to pay off their freeloader debt, which is the most horrific thing, after working, after slave labor.
Yeah, but you're then expected to pay tens of thousands of dollars for the courses you've received in training you to do this. Had a friend who worked as a treasury secretary in the Los Angeles organization for 20 years or something, Mark Plummer. All he was ever trained in doing was how to do Scientology's finances. And he was moving money into accounts for Ron Hubbard to make sure that he'd be able to get the money, because it's all for the good of the cause. But at the end of it all, he didn't get any other Scientology. He didn't have any auditing. He didn't train at anything else. He only trained to do this financial thing. At the end of it, they hit him with a freeloader bill for having trained him to do this. And it's like, this is absolutely unbelievable. Yeah.
Right. It is so entitled and so superior. I'm so grateful that you're doing this deep dive, that you are finding out all of this information. I mean, it's fascinating. It's very disturbing. It's hard to look at. It's hard to look at when you, I mean, especially for me, reading so much about the Nazi Party. And I actually went to something recently that was to celebrate the fact that there is a performance that happened last weekend here in Los Angeles, an all Yiddish production of Fiddler on the Roof, first since 1915. And they had to teach people Yiddish because about 80 to 90% of the people who were killed in the Holocaust who were Jewish were Yiddish speakers. So the language nearly died with them. But it was a language that had been around since the Middle Ages, 900 or so years old. And so there's so much that dies along with people. And when we talk about what happens when you get involved in Scientology, people will often talk about feeling like their personality's been crushed, that part of them, their will, their trust in humanity, their trust in themselves has died. There are these little deaths along with so much of the picture that we're looking at here. I am so glad that you're bringing things to light. I don't think that Scientology is going to be taking over the world, but you're right. I mean, these ideas have been passed along from narcissist to narcissist, from insecure persona to insecure persona, from the ones who feel entitled to treat people this way and the ones who really want to divide and conquer. They will always be with us. So it's something really to watch out for. It is a cautionary tale. And I'm happy that you're telling it.
Thank you. It's important to me. I really strenuously believe that to overcome a belief, you need to understand it. And it bothers me that there are all of these channels with hundreds of thousands of people on them talking about the hurt that Scientology caused or other groups caused, bringing you up to date on what's happening in the group now, but without getting into how do you get over it? How do you get through it? And a large part of that for me is to challenge the beliefs. I would like to see groups, online groups, what have you, where people can talk about the beliefs and they can decide whether affinity reality communication does add up to understanding or whether it's a stupid idea, which it is. Because of course, Hubbard's, the more you communicate with somebody, the more they'll like you. Well, as he said, bullets are communication. So, and yelling at people doesn't make them like you more. It's a silly idea. But having people, they need to dig that out rather than me telling them or anybody telling them. They need to go, oh yeah, he was wrong about that. And until you've detached from that, while there's still this thought of this is the source, the greatest person who ever lived, until you can question that, then the belief is still going to keep on functioning. You're not going to get rid of it. And the other thing is understanding the etiology. Recently, I've been talking with Anne L. Peterson, who's written a book about her experience. Close experience with Werner Erhard. She first came to it. She wrote a book called Is This a Cult? And she was still asking those questions. We've talked, she's been talking with Chris Shelton as well. And she's been able to keep thinking and go, well, yes, this human potential movement, it's a mirage. It's entrapped people, it's destroyed people. And when I looked at it, I started looking more and more at Est and to Erhard's official biography, William Bartley III, which is approved. And he's talking about having dipped into all of these Scientology groups, spent about 10 minutes studying each of them, packaged it up and sold it. And again, there is no research behind this. This is not about empowering people. This is about hypermania, as John Hunter has pointed out in his excellent Manufacturing Mania. You're just getting people to feel high, which I've also been saying for a long time, that Scientology is about creating euphoria. And then just as with the drug, you want that experience again. And you don't get any better. In fact, you're cloning narcissism. You're making people ever more selfish, ever more, where am I getting the money from for my next level? Ever more, I'm not talking to you anymore because you disagree with me. So you're hardening them. The measure of a good therapy is, how do you get on in your relationships? How are the people around you finding you now? If they're all going, oh, wow, you're doing really well, then something is going on. If it's making you ostracize people, you know, we've just put up a thing, which is with some Roehampton University have put forward a survey on ostracism. And I would very much like it if as many people as possible take, it's an anonymized survey, many people as possible do this, because we need to understand that just that simple thing, disconnection, shunning, disfellowshipping, sending to Coventry, is so psychologically destructive. And they're part of the Open Minds Initiative against mandated shunning, which has caught fire in the ex-Jehovah's Witness movement, but needs to go further, forcing people not to associate. So I think it's very important to understand the etiology, to understand how did these ideas develop. And I would challenge anybody who believes in the Nazi ideology to read this book and talk to me about how can you possibly believe these absurdities, which will lead to and have led to the commission of atrocities.
Right. And even this idea that we talk about with shunning and disconnection and all of it, yes, when it happens, it's devastating, devastating, devastating. But even the threat of it is enough to have people behave, stay in line, because they see what it can do, or just the fear of it, especially when you've taken away the rest of the world from people, and this is it, and this is the answer, or this is where their cultivated mania exists, this is where the high is, then just telling someone that they're no longer going to get their fix, or they're no longer going to be protected, whatever it is that they can only get there, again, scarcity idea, then yeah, that is enough to cause people to say, okay, I will do what you say. And so, yes, we are all too susceptible to these forces, and it's very good to know it. It's actually imperative to know it. Thank you, John, for all that you do and for all that you illuminate. It's important to look at it, even if it's difficult.
Absolutely. It's like going to the dentist. It can be difficult, but you can feel so much better afterwards.
Yes, right, exactly. Thank you so much, John.
A pleasure.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to John. I'm glad I gave him more of a chance to talk this time than the first time. I had a lot to say the first time. But John always has so much to share with us. It is quite incredible to see how, like, there's nothing new under the sun, that history repeats itself. So much of what we see, too, when one Machiavellian persona, someone who really, really needs to be able to have so much control, sort of tumbles into the story of someone else who also has such similar ways of interacting with the world, with needing to be militaristic, with needing to hold on to what they think is the best way to be, without being able to be expansive and open and tolerant. And something I talked to John about briefly is about this idea in psychology that a healthy mind is a flexible mind. That means that what's considered healthy, according to psychology, is when somebody is willing to take on new information, might have a bias against someone, but once they learn that the thing that they don't like about that other person might not be true, or that it might show that there's something wrong with them for needing to look down on this other person, then they'll take that in and they'll shift their way of thinking. That's a flexible mind. And these are people who are quietly confident in the world. They walk through their life not needing to prove something, not needing to push someone down to stand on their back to raise themselves up. They just go about their day. And just like the scientific model, they take in new information as it comes and they integrate it. And it doesn't threaten them to think about things in different ways. When we talk about groups like Scientology, though, it's so much about being threatened. So many people within this group feel threatened all the time about being judged, being watched. And people also who are relatives of mine, other people within my community who dealt with the Holocaust, have dealt with pogroms in their ancestors' lineage, they have this sense that they need to constantly watch their back. I remember when I was growing up that within a Jewish household, you're often told to make sure that your passport is always up to date. That's a very, very sad statement. I didn't realize how sad until I started seeing some of the things resurfacing that I realized made my ancestors feel like it was necessary to be ready to go at any moment. When you are also dealing with being in these environments where people are so warlike and so competitive, and they need to push you down and they need to exert their control over you, you have people who have a very hard time managing their nervous systems once they've left and feeling like they can be safe in the world. I have a story, actually, that I haven't thought of for a very long time. When I came back from working and raising my little ones in New York back to California to continue raising them here, I was looking for an office space, and before I found this one, I was looking around near where we were going to be living, and I just followed random ads that I saw in the cities where I wanted to be able to work. And I remember going into a building and meeting with a woman who seemed really lovely, a bit older than I was. She was about to retire. And she said, "Tell me a little bit about the kind of counseling you do. If you work with children, I have some toys here and I have some sand trays and other things that I think would be great. You're welcome to have them. I won't be using them anymore." Really lovely offer. And I said, "Yes, I have a background in special education and working with children and working with families and working with the siblings of kids with special needs, which I hope to be able to continue to do. And I also have this area of specialization." And she was just actually handing me a cup of water at the time. There was this water dispenser and she had asked me if I wanted some, and it was a very hot summer day. And I said, "Yes, please." And as she's handing me this glass of water, before I take it, because she was crossing the room to hand it to me, I told her this area of specialization that I had was working with people who had been with manipulators and had been in cults. And she dropped the cup of water. It wasn't even that she put it down. She just dropped it. And I thought, maybe she has trouble with her hands, maybe that's part of the reason she's retiring, she's having physical issues. And she just said, "Get out." I was shocked. And I think she could see how shocked I was. And I said, I don't know what happened, but I will get out. I'm not sure why you're so upset." And she said, "You're not sure? You're not here? They didn't send you here?" I didn't know who she was talking about. And I think she could tell genuinely that I didn't know what she was talking about. So she handed me a paper towel so I could clean off my outfit because it now had water splashed all over it from the cup hitting the ground and the water coming out of it. And I said, "Can you tell me what's so upsetting? I really will leave, but maybe there's something that I need to know." And she told me, and I wish I could remember her name, although it's probably good that I don't, just for her protection. I probably would know not to say it on the podcast anyway, even if I did remember it. But she said that her father was L. Ron Hubbard's ghostwriter. And because he was priding himself on being such a wonderful author, I thought, that's interesting that he had a ghostwriter. Maybe not for everything, but for some things. And he was becoming disenchanted with Scientology. And then they were worried that he would let people know that he was L. Ron Hubbard's ghostwriter. So they fair gamed him. They went after him. Actually, she said they drove him crazy. They did gaslighting en masse, making him feel like he was losing his mind. And eventually he committed suicide. She was carrying this around with her, hadn't told this story. She said she had shared it with her own therapist, but that was the only person she had shared it with. And here it was, this random meeting of me just following an ad. And it made me really wonder how many more stories there are out there, not only from Scientology, but other people who have been harmed, other people who have been in hiding, other people who have had to stay silent, other people whose lives have ended because of what they've been put through. And no one knows. And that's part of the reason that I decided to do this podcast, so that people would know. And I think that's part of the reason that John is as prolific as he is in his writing and his research, to help people understand, to help people really know how far-reaching this toxicity can be and how much they get away with. Thank you again to John for all that he researches and all that he does. And I hope to talk to him again soon. And to you, take good care. And I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are we exposed? Security teams ask this every day. Vulnerabilities across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos hide the truth, and attackers are watching. Tenable unifies your tools, teams, and data so you can spot and close risks fast. Tenable's AI-powered exposure management gives teams one view of risk, helping them focus, take action, and close critical exposures fast. Visit Tenable.com. Tenable. Your exposure ends here.